Hi there, and thanks for listening. If you're enjoying our podcast and have a recommendation about someone you think we should have on to share their voice and journey with the world, by all means, let us know. It could be an aid worker, monastic, author, journalist, doctor, resistance leader, really anyone with some tie or another to the ongoing situation in Myanmar or anything related to its history or culture. To offer up a name, go to our website, insightmyanmar.org, and let us know. But for now, just sit back and take a listen to today's episode.
My guest today is Max Mork from the Border Consortium, and we're going to be discussing the plight, but also potential rays of light on the horizon for the large and increasing Burmese refugee population living in Thailand. We've got quite a bit to cover, including changes to Thai policy and the history and the development of this pretty significant humanitarian crisis. But before we get into that, Max, thank you very much for joining us and very much for sharing the wisdom and the insights that you have through your organization. I want to give you the chance to introduce yourself for the audience first.
Thank you for having me. Yes, like you said, I'm Max Mork. I'm Head of Program Development and Quality Assurance for the Border Consortium.
Excellent, excellent. And so let's just dive into the Border Consortium here. What exactly does the Border Consortium work with?
The Border Consortium was formed in 1984 in response to a refugee displacement from Karen State along the Thai-Myanmar border. Since then, we've been the main provider of food, shelter, nutritional support, and technical support to CBOs and CSOs working in the nine camps along the border. Unfortunately, 41 years later, we're still here. We're still providing assistance to refugees. We have over 100,000 refugees along nine camps along the border. Many tens of thousands of refugees are outside the camps in hiding in rural Thai communities, remote communities along the border. And then, of course, we also have tens of thousands, at least 50,000 refugees, perhaps, in urban areas in Thailand. So unfortunately, the situation as we see it today is really quite as dire as we've seen in the past. So that's what TBC does. We work very closely with local communities and with refugee run government structures working in the camps.
And so I don't want to sort of bring up particularly negative hypotheticals, but I think it's valuable to ask the question just to understand exactly the role and the function that TBC has. As you say, you're a major source of things like nutrition. If TBC did not exist and you were not able to provide the commodities and the services that you provide, what would happen to the refugees in the nine camps?
I mean, I think before I answer that, I need to talk a little bit about the structure of the camps, because there are certain restrictions and impositions upon refugees and the refugee camps, which would really, really inform my response. So, The nine camps are run effectively by refugees for refugees. That's kind of been the way since the start back in 1984 when the Karen Refugee Committee started running MELA. So, however, the nine camps do come under the purview of the Rao Thai government. And ultimately, it's the Rao Thai government who is responsible for looking after the safety and security of the camps. And one of the measures to do of that is effectively refugees are not allowed to leave the camp without official permission. So for, I mean, over 40 years, refugees were in the camps and they were not allowed to leave the camp, let's say, to work outside. So what that meant is over time, they became dependent on humanitarian assistance, humanitarian assistance provided by TBC and other INGOs. For TBC, we're the provider of food. So for over four decades, refugees had become dependent on humanitarian assistance. And that's not a reflection on refugees. I mean, refugees are incredibly remarkable. They're working day in, day out to provide for their communities, but they're working under a set of assumptions and a set of regulations that prohibited them from working. So if you're not allowed to work, then by nature, you are then dependent upon someone else giving assistance. And that was pretty much the structure and the how things worked for decades until earlier this year, where we have significant funding disruptions. And I think it's fair to say the humanitarian community is no longer in a position to fund or provide food for 100,000 refugees along the time in my border, and that's incredibly sad. But I think that's not a reflection of the kind of humanitarian context on the time in my border. You just have to look at Bangladesh, where we have over 1 million people dependent on humanitarian assistance, and there's been massive funding cuts. We can look at, Afghanistan, Sudan, Gaza, around the world, humanitarian crises are becoming underfunded, and we're seeing that played out here along the time in my border. The good news is there has been some policy changes which will have a huge impact on refugees' lives, and maybe I can just speak to them a little bit. Earlier this year, TBC, we realized we haven't been able to secure the funding that we've relied upon for decades. That means we have the resources to provide 100,000 refugees with food every month. To provide over 100,000 of refugees with food and with cooking fuel, it was over $1.3 million per month, every single month. And then this year, we realized we were no longer in a position to do that. And so that put us and it put the refugees in a very precarious position. I mean, look, we can say we spent every waking hour trying to find new sources of funding, trying to, bang the drum and to try and get attention and get funding for refugees along the border. But we were competing with a myriad of humanitarian crises around the world, which had just as acute, perhaps even more acute in some cases, demands. So once you lose a little bit of funding, it's very difficult to get that in return. So the other issue is that the situation in Myanmar is, effectively, we can say it's more dire today than it has been in decades. There's 3.5 million people displaced nationwide, 1.5 million displaced according to civil society in southeastern Myanmar, where the overwhelming majority of refugees in the nine camps are from. So then we're faced with a situation. And the other factor that also happened earlier this year, a lot of things happened in Q1, Q2 of this year, was that refugee resettlement was halted and then suspended. So that means for refugees in the camps, they have effectively three options for their future. Well, they can return to Myanmar. Well, I think it's fair to say that's not a viable option for mass repatriation right now, when every single day more refugees are coming over the border. It's not really, it doesn't feel right for the humanitarian community or safe, to talk about repatriation in that context. Resettlement was the second option. And over the last 18 months or so, or throughout 2024, there was a new refugee resettlement process that had gone on. Over roughly around 50,000 refugees had registered to be resettled in the US. And then in the first quarter of 2025, that was suspended and then terminated. So, I mean, there are still some resettlement opportunities for refugees, but we're talking, in the tens or hundreds a year. These are not whole of community solutions. And if we're talking about the refugee community as a whole, they can't return to Myanmar. They can't be resettled in a third country. So then the only option is to stay in Thailand. And so then the question isn't where are refugees going to go? It's what are refugees going to do? What is refugees' future in Thailand going to look like? Are they going to be confined into refugee camps without access to legal work, but crucially, without food. That's not possible, right? That's unacceptable. There has to be a better way. And so this was really the context that the Refugee Right to Work program policy was designed and implemented. So we were having this situation where refugees were, you know, looking down the barrel of the gun, realizing there is going to be no food. So therefore, the only option really is to work outside. And so this is the kind of, you know, the factors that led up to, on the 26th of August, the Thai Parliament passing a resolution to allow refugees the right to work. And this is historic. You know, there's been in the kind of post-World War II era or the kind of, you know, the modern Thai state, refugees have been here been in Thailand since 1975 with the Indo-Chinese refugee crisis. And at no point have refugees ever been allowed to work. So really, after 5 decades, we're seeing a new policy and one that's reacting to a changing humanitarian context. So then on the 1st of October, the policy was implemented, was passed. And so now refugees eligible refugees can then apply for work permits, and then they can leave the camp and support their families. It's research we've done with the Karen Refugee Committee shows that within 1 week of working outside, a refugee can earn more than TBC would be historically able to provide in food assistance over a month. So really, we do see this as a durable solution. It's a solution that provides many opportunities to refugees, but also it provides food security when, unfortunately, you know, organizations like TBC are no longer able to do that because we simply no longer have the funding. And I think another really important thing around this is, you know, I've been to the refugee camps hundreds of times. I speak to refugees all the time. It's a real privilege of part of my role being able to speak to refugees, refugee committees. The access to right to work has been a fundamental call since I've first been involved. And even before that, when I speak to colleagues who've been there since the beginning, really, when I speak to people 40, 50 years ago who were involved in refugees in Thailand, access to right to work has been a fundamental request from refugees since day one. Everyone wants to be self-dependent. And really, no one wants to be held hostage to the changing fluctuations of the international humanitarian funding, you know, peaks and troughs, as it were. So really, this is fantastic for refugees. It gives a lot of options to refugees. It gives them a solution to refugees outside the camps in a changing circumstance. So, I mean, the situation is very fluid. And again, where we are right now, late December, we've got around 2,000 of refugees who are working outside of the camp. And they're working all over Thailand, really. Some of them are working along the Cambodian border. Some of them are working in factories near Bangkok. Some of them are working along the Thai-Myanmar border. There's a huge demand for refugees. I mean, it was reported in the media a few months ago that the Thai sugarcane industry had 32,000 jobs for refugees. I mean, I think the other thing that I haven't mentioned, that the other thing I haven't mentioned is the other influence on this is, of course, the conflict with Cambodia, which erupted in around June of this year. And that led to estimates vary, but I've seen up to 500,000 Cambodian migrant workers have now returned to Cambodia. What that has meant is that private industry, agriculture, I mean, particularly agriculture, has suffered a huge loss of labor. And when you're getting into the end of the monsoon, end of the rainy season, and all of this agriculture, all of your, you know, your crops and your vegetables and your fruit, which has been harvested, it's very time limited to harvest that. You can't wait a couple of months for the situation to return. You can't wait to recruit migrant workers from other countries around the world. Really, it is time critical. So the availability, because I don't have 100,000 refugees in these 9 camps who have been verified, have been documented by the Thai government. You know, they've had public health vaccination programs rolled out there. Many of these refugees speak Thai. Many of them were born in Thailand. It's really, there's an economic imperative there as well. And so we saw really, you know, the private sector swing its weight behind the Refugee Right to Work program. So yeah, it's it's early days, but we see this as a really positive development. And, you know, we have to thank the Rao Thai government for designing and enabling this policy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's remarkable, really, how fast things have come. You know, some bits of policy, or creating policy in Thailand can take not months, it can take years. And here we have a policy that's really been developed, you know, rapidly to the changing needs along the camps. And we hope it'll continue to, you know, adapt over the coming months and years to ensure that refugees have the best option to meet their needs. Because if we are honest, look, the funding situation for the Thai-Myanmar border, for Myanmar as a whole, for Bangladesh, it's not going to get any better. Certainly not in the short to medium term. So we have to find new ways of funding, new ways of meeting humanitarian needs. And particularly, and I think this is really important here, if we look at kind of displaced populations or refugee populations as a whole on both sides of the Thai-Myanmar border, you know, you have refugees in the nine camps, you have refugees fleeing fleeing ongoing conflict outside of the camps along the border, and then you have urban refugees, but also then you have the 1.5 million displaced in the southeast. Out of all of that contingent, refugees in camp are the only one, because this is a protracted displacement, they're the only ones who have the, and this is all relative, the kind of safety and stability to get to work. And they're the only ones who have access to work opportunities. So if we can unlock this massive economic potential of 100,000 refugees, then it also means that, you know, TBC, like I said, that was $1.3 million per month to feed 100,000 refugees. Well, if we're doing, if we're all trying to, you know, do more with less, and then by reducing the amounts of funding that the humanitarian community has to provide to the nine camps, it means the money can go, that funding can then go to providing IDPs, to providing conflict-affected populations in Myanmar who are meeting and who are dealing with immediate conflict and ongoing trauma, who need, you know, emergency humanitarian response, be it, you know, food, medical, shelter. So it really, it eases, I don't mean the term burden in negative sense, but it eases the economic burden of dealing with refugees, and we can triage, we can prioritize those most in need. In other words, the refugees in the nine camps were the only ones that had a policy solution out, a policy solution or a policy pathway outside of camp. You know, quite a relatively, I mean, it's complex to design, but a relatively simple policy solution to 41 years of protracted displacement. Unfortunately, the 1.5 million IDPs in the southeast, there's not a simple policy solution for them, right? So that's when the immediate humanitarian funding needs to continue and needs to be directed and prioritized to those refugees. So, I mean, there's, you know, there's so many moving parts in this. And what I'm saying right now, by the maybe by the time this podcast goes out of date, there'll be some developments and things may be looking a little bit different. But that's kind of where we stand today. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think you've opened so many different avenues of discussion here that I want to jump into. But one of the ones that I think we have to clarify as early as possible in this discussion so that we do know what we're talking about. You mentioned that between these nine camps, you have about 100,000 refugees. And then outside of these camps, you're looking at north of 50,000 in various locales and various positions. The really big thing whenever we deal with refugees, whenever we talk about refugees, is understanding what do we mean when we say the word refugee? Because to the best of my understanding, and you said these 100,000 refugees in these nine camps are registered with the Thai government. Presumably they are registered as refugees. I just want to clarify, how does the Thai government approach this? What sort of categorization system are they using? And is this in hand with, or is this completely independent of the United Nations system for identifying and vetting refugees?
Yes, sure. So first thing is that according to, you know, kind of Rao Thai government policy, is there are no refugees in Thailand, but there are displaced persons. And again, there are no refugee camps, but there are temporary shelters. I mean, some of these temporary shelters have been there for over four decades. So Thailand, as we know, is not a signatory to the 1951 Refugee Convention or the 67 Protocol. Mm-hmm. So what I've been talking about really earlier on today is the 100,000 refugees, like 103,000 refugees in the nine camps. And they're a relatively, I'd say, unique population compared to refugees outside of camps because of the regulations, because of the access that INGOs have, whereas refugees outside, it's a very different operating scenario. Everything is quite, under the radar and a little bit... it's not fully out in the open, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. Yeah. But I think the thing here when we talk about refugees in Thailand, it's important to note that the first refugees on the Thai Myanmar border, it dates back not actually to 1984, but it actually goes back to 1975, which is when the founding of the Karen Refugee Committee. There have been refugees on this border for decades. Mm. And then, of course, throughout Myanmar's history, there's been, political events have caused waves of exodus. And that can be, 1988. It can be the 1995 fall of Manipur. It can be 2007 Saffron Revolution. Then, of course, February the 1st, 2021, where we've seen, I think around 20,000, 30,000 refugees enter the nine camps. But also, again, all of the urban refugees in places like Mysore, Chiang Mai, Bangkok, and of course, refugees are elsewhere along the border. So it's a little bit difficult, really, to talk about refugees as a whole, as a collective. Because even, let's say, even if we forget about all nine camps, even if we just look at, let's say, one refugee camp in particular, let's say Mela, because that's probably the one that people listening may be familiar with. There's 40,000 people in Mela. There are people within Mela who were born in Myanmar and fled in the mid to late 80s. There are people in Mela who were born in Thailand who have never been back to Karen State or to Myanmar. There's people who've arrived since the coup. Kind of talking about communities, I mean, it's challenging, right? Because as policymakers or as kind of humanitarians, we have to have kind of mass responses. But actually, there are so many differences in needs, in vulnerabilities, and if we do a protection analysis, every individual is different. And I think particularly within when we're talking about refugees in Thailand, it's really quite important to acknowledge the differences in approach, in legality, or in terms of what sort of legal status refugees have, because it really differs both for refugees who've arrived before and after the coup, refugees inside, outside of the camps. It's really quite multifaceted and quite complex, which makes designing policy, designing programs really quite challenging. And I think the other thing when we talk about this, when we talk about refugees, particularly on the, let's say in around Mesod or on the Thai Myanmar border, the thing that we often don't talk about is migrant workers. We see them in an entirely separate category, right? Mm-hmm. But actually, depending on how many, every other day I hear a different estimate of how many migrant workers there are in Thailand. I'm including both documented and undocumented there. It could be 4 million. I've heard up to, 8, 9, 10 million. The fact is there are millions of migrant workers in Thailand. They may have originally left particularly migrant workers who left before the coup. They may have left for economic reasons, but they can no longer return home, potentially. I mean, the vast majority cannot return home because of political reasons. So there is also, an argument within that to also treat them as refugees. Because refugee status in some circumstances is not determined about why you left the country. It's about whether you can return or not. I don't think I really answered your question. I think I've just thrown out more questions, really. But I think it's a really quite intriguing... it's quite challenging when we try to attribute labels, because actually, you know, as I said before, from a policy or kind of, you know, program perspective, we do have to have certain categorizations.
Yeah.
But it's also realizing the disparate nature within within populations.
No, and I think it's an incredibly important and valuable thing to bring up. And again, you know, I only raised the question because talking about legal frameworks and understanding, as you say, that there's a very, very, very large number of people from Myanmar who, for whatever reason, find themselves in Thailand and find themselves unable to return to Myanmar. Many of them, as you say, are in very legally distinct positions, even though their actual life circumstances may be very similar to one another. And so it's just, I think it's important to understand when we talk about the rollout of a policy, and I'm going to get to the work to write policy because I have questions on that, and I think it's going to be really interesting for us to delve into its potential and its long-term ramifications. But when we talk about something like the right to work policy, it is, I think, important to understand which people are going to be affected by this. And I don't want to get into it too much at this stage because I want to save it for that part. But no, I appreciate the sort of pushback, and I appreciate the clarification on that. Before we move off that, though, I want to ask you to do something which is a little bit, I think it's something that's very difficult to do, which is to paint a picture of what these camps are, because hearing the words refugee camp, we hear that again and again and again and again. And I'm sure people have seen isolated sort of snapshots and clips of footage, but that doesn't necessarily explain to us what a refugee camp in this context actually is. And just doing the basic maths here, each one of these nine camps would have to hold 11 or 12,000 people over a period of over 40 years. Or having grown up to 11 to 12,000 people. So I want to ask you if you can illustrate for us in some way, shape, or form what these camps are, how big are they, what are the living conditions like, what activities do people undertake in these camps, and what is the relationship between the nine camps, how far spread are they, and things like this.
Yeah, of course. So first of all, I'll kind of jump back to 1984. Really, at that time, the Tatmadaw, the Burmese army, was launching a number of offensives in Karen State. And this is particularly 1984, mid to late 80s. This was focused in Karen State. And villages would be displaced. They'd be displaced from the fighting, particularly villages along the Myanmar side of the, you know, Thai-Burma border. They would be displaced into Thailand. And then effectively an entire village would be transplanted from Thailand from Burma into, effectively an entire village would be transplanted from Karen State in Myanmar over to Thailand. And the refugees would stay there for a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months. And then often during the rainy season, when, you know, logistically fighting becomes very difficult, particularly in the jungle, fighting would die down, refugees would return home. That kind of pattern of temporary displacement was going along pretty much since the early 70s. But then come 1984, refugees had again been pushed out into Thailand, in this case to Mela, just north of Mesot. And then when the rainy season came, the fighting didn't stop. And the Tatmadaw weren't pushed back from their positions. So refugees found, well, actually, we can't go back to our villages. We have to stay in Thailand because, you know, the Tatmadaw, the Burmese military, are either occupying our village or they're incredibly close. It's not safe for us to return home. So what you had in the mid-80s is effectively you had, I think it's up over 30 tiny little refugee camps along the border. And these aren't refugee camps as we know them today. These are, you know, small, displanted villages. So effectively you had almost an entire village being transplanted from one side of the border to the other. So as a result, they looked like villages. I mean, they built houses themselves out of, you know, bamboo, eucalyptus. It doesn't take particularly long to build these houses if you have the skills. And so relatively organically, you had a number of these small villages popping up along the border that were, from an outsider's point of view, they looked identical to ones in Myanmar. And of course, along the border, there's huge Karen populations anyway. So it kind of from a aesthetical point of view, it's almost impossible to tell a refugee camp in those days from a normal village. But then what effectively happened is that these, you have 30, 40 refugee camps along the border. Well, they were getting attacked by the, they were getting attacked by the Burmese military. And then later on, they were getting attacked by the DKBA. So effectively, over the decades, these disparate small refugee camps slowly became consolidated into the 9 camps we have today. I don't know if you have been to Mela, but perhaps some of the listeners have. You'll know Mela refugee camp has quite a striking mountain right to the left of it. It's right behind the mountain. Well, it was actually moved there. Originally, Mela, the refugee camp, was right on the border. So it's, you know, it was within striking distance from the Burmese army. That's why it was moved. But effectively, so kind of moving to the present day, we have these 9 refugee camps. They don't all look the same at all. So yeah, Mela has 40,000 people. It's on the highway. It's on the main highway coming out of Mesot. It's about an hour away from Mesot. You have a big market there. You have internet access. You have you can even get Shopee and Lazada deliveries there sometimes. But actually, that's not indicative of what most refugee camps are. For example, Ban Me Surin in Mehon Song, it's got 3,000, 4,000 people. It's a tiny camp that's on the bend of a river. It's hours away. It's about 3 to 4 hours drive away from Mehon Song. Part of the road literally goes through a river. You can't pass it if there's been heavy raining season. If there's been heavy rain, there is very limited electricity. There is no phone signal, very limited access to Wi-Fi. These are very remote communities and they're all disparate. But I think the one thing I haven't mentioned that's actually most important to mention is kind of how these, I mentioned before, these refugee camps kind of grew organically, albeit with a consolidation for safety reasons, because they were too vulnerable from attack. But so these refugee camps grew organically over time. So over 4 decades, they've evolved. But what the important thing is here is the refugee camps, they're not run by TBC. They're not run by other INGOs. They're not run by UNHCR. They're run by refugees. They're run by the Refugee Committee, which runs 7 refugee camps, and the Karenni Refugee Committee, which runs 2 refugee camps. And they're supported by a whole host of other, you know, the Karen Women's Organization, Karen Youth Organization, Karenni Women's Organization, a whole host of CBOs and local civil society. So actually, if you picture a refugee camp in your mind, you immediately think of, you know, plastic sheeting, UNHCR logos. But actually, the camps, because they've been there for so long, and because the other thing to mention is that shelter materials are restricted. You can only build a house in a refugee camp with a set number of materials, and these are namely bamboo and eucalyptus. So you don't really see, I mean, so the refugee camps, the buildings within them look very similar to buildings you see in rural Thai communities and in Karen and Karenni state. So actually, on a visual level, if you don't see some of the donor logos, it looks pretty similar to a normal village. Which, and again, life in the camp, it looks normal to a village. If you go into a refugee camp, you know, 7-8 o'clock in the morning, there'll be people going to work, there'll be children going to school, there'll be people going to, you know, look after animals, there'll be people sitting around drinking tea, you know, having a gossip, you know, having a chat to start the day. It's a very normalized existence. And I'm fairly sure if I took a photo of some of parts of a refugee camp without, you know, you didn't see a donor logo and I showed it to someone, you wouldn't assume it's a refugee camp, and you wouldn't assume it's in Thailand. You may say, oh, this is in Karenni state, this is in Karen state. So really, I think the key thing here, though, is that these camps have been here for 41 years. So over 41 years, things take on, it's no longer emergency, it's no longer an emergency response, right? And the other thing is refugees are very aware of the kind of the constraints and the conditions on them. So you're aware, okay, well, let's say, I mean, this has been the case for decades. Well, it's not safe to go back home. Maybe the resettlement program isn't operational right now. We don't have access to work in Thailand at this point. So therefore, we're going to stay here. We will make this area a nice, strong community. That's why you have all these community groups. That's why you have well over 1,000, I think it's around 1,600 refugees who are working themselves in the camp. And these can be as nurses, these can be as teachers, these can be as community leaders, security, working with shelter, nutrition. So really, it's quite a dynamic, very diverse, and it's very busy. Refugee camps are very, very busy. They're always noisy, the kind of noise of day-to-day life of people going around their business, going to work. Look, that's not to say, I'm not trying to paint a particularly, an overtly or kind of anachronistically positive spin on this. Of course, there is a massive amount of stress. There is a lot of pressure on refugees, particularly at the moment due to, funding reductions and fluctuations within humanitarian service provision. But on the whole, I think the refugee camps here look really quite remarkable and remarkably different, I should say, remarkably different to other refugee camps and kind of displacement settings around the world. And that's primarily down to the Karen Refugee Committee and the Kareni Refugee Committee by making sure camps are run by refugees for refugees. The refugee committee, they live in the camp. It's actually refugees themselves who are elected. There are elections held every 3 years for camp leaders, for zone leaders, for committee leaders, for CBOs. So it's been a remarkable, on an academic level, it's been a remarkable experiment in local refugee governance structure. On the kind of the pragmatic or practical level, it's incredibly cost efficient. You look at the cost of hosting refugees around the world. In parts of Africa, parts of in Europe, I mean, in the UK, it's £20,000-£30,000. Obviously, in Australia, if you're hosting people in a migrant detention center in Nauru, it's going to be hundreds of thousands. For TBC, it costs $186 per refugee per year to provide food, shelter, nutritional support, and then support to refugees. I mean, that's not every single other humanitarian agencies also provide assistance, but to feed and house a refugee, you're talking 50 cents a day. That is, that's cost effective. It is. And that's all because it's refugees themselves who are taking the lead. You're not paying, highly paid, expensive foreign consultants to, parachute in. It's because actually you're leveraging the strengths of refugees themselves. If there has been a crisis, we have the mandate of looking after shelter. There was a flood in Mela a couple of months ago. I think 165 houses were damaged. Within the hour, you have a needs request, a needs assessment that's being filled out. Why? Because it's been filled out by the people in the camp. They know exactly what has happened. You have this very efficient system. You're not waiting. I've worked in the kind of response to a natural disaster in other places in the world, and you're waiting, sometimes for 2 or 3 days for these kind of foreign search and rescue teams to come in and then provide the needs assessment. And then it takes days and days and days. Whereas in a refugee camp, you have a direct line. We can call someone up in a camp and say, hey, what's the situation? What do you need?
Because this is what I wanted to ask. It may be quite a sophomoric question, but the way I visualize the evolution of these refugee camps, and based on the way that you're describing them, is that they are very organic. They evolved naturally out of, just in response to the pressures that those populations were under. And as you say, it was a series of small villages, and then over time they become consolidated. And that sort of reminds me very much of early human societies, where the earliest large walled settlements were basically just that. It was a large number of people who decided, for ease of economic opportunity and for mutual protection and benefit, it's better for us to group together and it's better for us to choose to collaborate. But the thing in those early settlements and early societies was that there was not clear evidence of any leadership structure. And yet here, it seems, as you're saying, it's not even just that the camp has its own administration, but there's an administrative group that oversees 7 of these major camps and another administrative group that oversees 2 of these camps. So the question is, what is the functional role of administration in a refugee camp like this when, from your description, a lot of people have their own chores, tasks, jobs. They're, you know, tending animals. I assume there are a lot of people who have trade skills that would be, you know, I assume making clothes, making shoes, preparing food, providing medical services and all that. That sort of seems like it would run itself. So what really day-to-day is that administration doing? And what if that administration did not exist, if the actual Karen and Kareni administration structures did not exist, and it were the Thai government, or it were the United Nations, or it were civil society organizations who had to replace all of the things that they do, what would you be required to do and to bring to bear to replace the work that they're putting in?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it may be useful if we kind of conceive the work of KRC and KNRC as a town council, effectively. Mm-hmm. You're pulling together, you're advocating on behalf of your community. I think it's probably it's useful to think of these entities as, say, as a town council. So you have elected representatives that can represent the entire camp, to, let's say, INGOs, to the roadside government. You need spokesmen or advocates who can advocate on behalf. That's one role they do. The other is social cohesion, is to work out issues within the camp. You know, it's with amongst 100,000 people living in very close quarters, you're going to have, you know, let's say disagreements. You're going to have issues around protection, around, let's say, environmental mismanagement. And this is what they're able to provide leadership on, able to provide, you know, maybe there's a huge amount of work they do on protection, on ensuring the camps are, you know, are safe environments where everyone can feel protected. So there's particularly the women's organizations, Karen Women's Organization, Kareni Women's Organization, they take a really strong lead in protection, in the kind of protection mandate, ensuring refugees are safe. They also have a security mandate. So they're actually within the camps. There are refugee security staff kind of basically keeping social order. They provide avenues for, you know, discussion, for airing grievances, for coming together, providing maybe new opportunities. If there's, let's say, a scholarship program, the camp committee can disseminate that throughout the community. Look, maybe one of the best ways of kind of explaining this would be an example is during COVID-19. Really, you know, COVID-19, if we look back at COVID-19, particularly in the refugee camps, there was a lot of uncertainty and confusion. I mean, particularly for, I'd say, back in the early days, in early 2020, organizations like TBC, there was a lot of limitations on accessing the refugee camps. So it wasn't that INGOs could come in and provide a lot of, let's say, trainings or information, educational awareness ourselves. But it's actually the camp communities could take a role, could take a leadership role in disseminating information around, you know, mm-hmm. COVID best practice. But I think the kind of thing I'm getting to here, which is probably the best example, is in some of the refugee camps, there was a lot of vaccine hesitancy. There were refugees, there were certain communities within refugee camps didn't want to take the vaccine. What we had is that refugee camp leaders were offered to be filmed having the vaccine themselves. And as a direct result of that, we saw vaccine rates shoot up in the camps. Effectively, there are town council. Any refugee in any camp has multiple avenues to make a complaint if they're not happy with how things are in camp. And that could be a complaint about the work of, it could be the camp committee itself, it could be TBC, it could be another INGO, it could be, you know, a grievance. They can also, and that could be a grievance with, let's say, humanitarian service delivery that they don't felt was provided adequately or fairly. It can be a dispute with a neighbor. It could be with a particular protection concern they have, or a particular vulnerability they've had. For many years, a food assistant, let's say, in the camp was given on the results of a protection needs assessment. It's called a community-managed targeting. And if circumstances within a family had changed, let's say, for example, the main breadwinner was no longer able to go to work, they could then appeal through the camp committee to have increased humanitarian assistance as a result of that. Mm-hmm. So really, they are representatives. They are representatives externally. They're representing the camp. They can talk about what the camp needs, what their strengths are, where they need extra support on. Let's say, what are their kind of fears or challenges? And then internally, they act as a mediator, as an arbitrator. Basically ensuring, you know, kind of socially harmonious, socially cohesion events. Just last week, it was Karen New Year. The refugee committees put on a big, they put it off on a football pitch. There was a beauty pageant. There was a lot of sport competitions, music. Providing the community, I think, is also really important. That kind of community support structure, they really are essential within that. And then to kind of come on to your second question, what would we do without them, or maybe a better way is how could we replace them? It's impossible. If you were to, I mean, look, there are people in refugee, let's say in Mela, we have refugees, predominantly from Karen State, but we also have some Burmese refugees, you know, Bama refugees, Kareni. We also have some Lahu, some Shan, some Rakhine, Kachin, Naga. How are you going to provide translators for all of these, externally provide them? You know, how are you going to ensure all of their needs are met? And I think the other thing is, what is inherent within this is trust.
Yeah.
It's trust. And this is something that when you come from a particular community and you're in charge of representing that community, actually, you are far more accountable than you and I. Because you and me, we go home at the end of our day. Whereas if you are in a camp committee, you are going to your home in a refugee camp. actually, you know, you are a lot more accountable. You're in your daily interactions. So I think there's that, but also there's a big power dynamic as well. You know, I've been to many meetings, be it in refugee camp settings or just around the world, where outsiders, be it researchers, be it, you know, as academics, journalists, or humanitarian actors, and we'll sit in front of a bunch of people who we've barely introduced ourselves to, working through a translator, and say, "Hi, I'm doing this study for this, this, and this. What are your biggest challenges in life?" Or, you know, tell me something very vulnerable, or talk about your protection status, or, you know, really difficult questions, really quite personal questions. And there's huge barriers to that. There's actually a lot of systemic issues within that. So actually going through members of the community, it's quite a neat sidestep. It negates so many of these issues. I think it's, as a model, it emerged very organically. And then over the last couple of decades, it has grown partly in response to increasing demands, legitimate demands around, you know, accountability, monitoring, evaluation by kind of, you know, the humanitarian industry. And now it's become very fashionable to talk about localization. And I'm sure we can all think of examples of localization where development actors or INGOs or the UN talk about localization, but actually is it localization in practice? Whereas actually what we have in the camps has been localization before that was even a concept. It's been localization since day one. And I think that's really important that's recognized that this is not a new approach. This is not people, you know, it's not INGOs handing power over to refugees. They always had that power. And it is also quite important to highlight again, just how cost effective this is. And I think, we always have to be as cost effective. We always have to be as efficient as possible. But I'd say this year, looking ahead to next year, that's going to be imperative. We have to be as efficient as possible and find ways of making savings and working with refugee populations themselves. I mean, I cannot think of a more cost effective, a more efficient, and a more ethical, and a more effective way to work.
One pushback to that, just in a hypothetical sort of academic sense, because I want to essentially ask you whether you think the information that we have gleaned from not just the creation, the formation, and the continued existence of this governance structure in these camps, but also, as you say, the overwhelming success and cost efficiency of this governance structure, would be applied proactively and consciously in other refugee situations in other parts of the world. And the one question that does still sort of niggle at me on that is that I think in Myanmar, because of this shared suffering at the hands of the Burmese military, the various ethnic groups, religious groups, language groups, identity groups, cultural groups have all across the nation temporarily set aside any animosity that may or may not exist. And by temporarily, I do mean for an extended period of time, actually. They've set aside that animosity because they recognize that they are all sort of bonded by this shared suffering at the hands of this large, evil, destructive entity. And that is a wonderful thing to see, and it's excellent. The level of cooperation that we've seen from resistance organizations in Karen State and Karenni State and all across the country is truly inspirational. Is it, however, in other refugee situations, in other crisis situations, other conflict situations around the world, is it, do you think, still viable to try to say, you know, refugee camps should have their own internally appointed governance structure, representation structure, or do you think that it would be a problem that in a lot of these cases, conflict exacerbates underlying animosities and tensions and distrust? And is there not something to be said for the impartiality and neutrality of outside actors who are not accountable? Very, very fair complaint. They're not accountable, but they also do not have preferences for one group over another.
Yeah, well, I think it's not one or the other, right? Mm-hmm. This isn't how the refugee communities work is they work in conjunction with INGOs. Ultimately, the funding decision wouldn't be with the Karen wouldn't be with refugee committees, right? It would be with either the INGOs or the donors who are working with INGOs. So I get your point and get your question, mm-hmm. but actually I feel right now we have I think it works quite well. We have the best of both worlds, where it is amongst local civil society represent needs of a population, and they will present that to an NGO, and then the NGO will go, well, okay, this looks great, but hang a minute, what about this? What about this? What about this? Mm-hmm. And I think to answer your point around, let's say, minority groups within these settings, I mean, within the refugee camps, we have the Coordinating Committee for Ethnic Groups, which ensures every ethnic minority in the camps has access to representation, has access to local language, materials, has access to... We have self-help groups, which also do the same thing with people with disability. I mean, look, it's not as if you were to establish this, if you were to, let's say, try this again somewhere else, on day one, you're going to have perfect social cohesion, perfect representation. Mm. You're not going to have a lot to work through. Of course you will. I mean, it's taken a long time to get to where we are now. But I think the alternative is if you're relying on outsiders coming in and making decisions, let's say around needs assessments, then you're missing so much information that you don't even know you're missing. I mean, look, if we just maybe a different example would be the response to the earthquake inside Myanmar by many NGOs. I don't think anyone is, no one's seriously making the argument that was effective. Working through the Myanmar military, working in military controlled areas, the same day they were, bombing civilian populations in Sagaing. No one is really saying that was effective. So I think I'm a little bit kind of reluctant to get into counterfactuals. I see that as, it's a distraction. And I see some of the pushback to greater involvement in civil society in the kind of humanitarian sector as pushback that it's pushback that assumes a status quo, and we're not, it's putting so much more accountability, so mm-hmm. much, we're holding refugee communities or conflict affected communities or civil society to a far greater standard than we are to the status quo, and we're making funding decisions around that, whereas we're not maybe casting that same light, that same accountability on kind of existing norms within the structure. And I'm talking globally here now, right? I'm not talking specifically, but I think there is so much more potential we can unlock around the world by, be it in the humanitarian sector, the development sector, using local or. Working with and working through local communities as opposed to relying on externally conducted needs assessments, let's say, on the proviso of accountability, because that doesn't always hold up.
No, and I think that's very reasonable, and it does sort of come down to one of those issues whenever we have an advancement, you know, technologically or medically or in any other field where people push back and say, well, I don't think we should be implementing this advancement because we have seen it fail and we've seen, you know, casualties as a result. And then there's that universal response, like, yeah, but the thing doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be better than what we have now. And if it is objectively better than what we have now, then there's really no reason to hold back just because it's not 100%. You know, I think you make a very compelling argument. I think you put it quite sort of eloquently and impassionedly. So, taking from there, moving to the modern political situation and the right to work. So, to start with, you mentioned, and I want to go back and make sure that I correctly understood. The policy was initially that not only are the refugees not allowed to work, but they're also not physically allowed to leave the camps. Is that correct?
It is, unless they had formal permission. And that permission could be for maybe an educational opportunity. Uh-huh. It could be for travel, let's say. It could be travel for a medical appointment or something, mm-hmm. or maybe moving from one camp to another. But all of this had to be, you know, written approval.
Yeah.
But yeah, in general, kind of talking broadly, yeah, refugees were not only not allowed to work outside the camp, but they also weren't allowed to leave the camps.
Wow.
And in fact, if they did leave the camp, if a refugee was to leave the camp, they were under Thai law, they would be treated as an illegal immigrant.
Oh, wow. So the refugee camp is almost like a refugee status zone in a way.
It's like a parallel state.
Interesting. Okay, so that's a curious thing, and I'm just wondering because it feels, and I'm just purely speculating, I don't actually know, but it feels like one of the reasons behind this, as is, you know, something that a lot of governments around the world do and say, when you have large migrant communities coming in, whether those are refugee communities or any other type of migrant community, that there is a fear that the migrants are going to enter the labor force and they're going to accept worse working conditions. They're going to accept lower pay and they're going to accept criminal negligence on the part of their employers. And in so doing, they're going to bar the local citizen population from being able to take those jobs and receive living wages and government guaranteed, you know, labor conditions. Within those positions, was that, do you think, part of the thinking in Thailand with regards to that at the time, that they didn't want local Thai laborers to be cut out of their own industries?
Look, I can't speak on behalf of the mm-hmm. of the Rawal Thai government, but I would assume that would be a major perspective, yeah. as well as not wanting a refugee population to kind of stay in Thailand indefinitely. But I think the issue with that argument is, I mean, as we were talking about before, there are millions of Myanmar migrants in Thailand. Yes. Actually, 100,000 refugees is a drop in the ocean compared to the wider, you know, Myanmar diaspora population within Thailand. So I think, and the all of those arguments could be applied to all of the, you know, all of those arguments could be applied to having, you know, a reliance on migrant labor. And the Thai economy is, we know it's, it is reliant on migrant labor. If you look at the kind of demographics, the Thai kind of economic, the Thai birth rate is really rather low. So I think we're going to be looking at a situation where Thailand, like, you know, Japan, like Korea, so many other countries in the world are going to be increasingly reliant on migrant labor. So I think those arguments there, I understand, you know, where they're coming from, but I don't think they hold a lot of water in 2025. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's very reasonable. But then, as you say, drop in the ocean. And I know that you mentioned before, if I remember the figure correctly, about 500,000 Cambodian migrant laborers have departed Thailand.
That's what I've seen. Look, I'm not an expert on the Cambodian border or on, you know, all on kind of Cambodian migrant workers, but I've seen that reported in the media. I mean, even if it's half that, that's still double the population in the camps. That's still a huge amount. So there is this huge demand for migrant labor within Thailand.
And I mean, as you say, like the agricultural sector is very time critical. Like harvest season is harvest season. You don't get to delay that by a month just because it's not convenient labor wise. So with regards to this new policy, the granting the right to work is, as you say, the 100,000 refugees in these nine camps is a drop in the ocean compared to, I think you said the low end of the spectrum was 2 to 4 million estimated Myanmar migrant workers / migrant residents in Thailand at the moment, up to significantly higher figures. Is granting the right to work more being done just for humanitarian reasons to grant these people the opportunity to support themselves and make the meaningful contributions that they're able to make? Or is there also that desire that we have, you know, 100,000 people sitting around whose potential is not being unlocked, and we have suddenly a shortage of laborers, and a hope that that refugee population is going to be able to step up and shore up that sort of sudden shortage that Thailand is facing?
I think it's a competing set of influences on this. Of course, a major factor was the conflict with Cambodia and the huge loss of labor force. But I think, again, the fact that funding pressures were so acute that TBC, that other humanitarian agencies were not able to secure the funding required. So there was a period earlier in the year where for 6 weeks we didn't have funding to provide food in the camps. And so then I think, again, I can't speak on behalf of the Raw Thai government, but effectively you have a series of options. If you're, you know, if you're a policymaker, you could let refugees be stuck in a camp with no food and no work opportunities. That's not an option at all. You could provide food themselves. You could provide food by yourself, but that's very expensive. Or you can unlock the potential of refugees and let them work. So, like I said, can't speak on behalf of the Thai government, but I would imagine it's a culmination of humanitarian imperative, economic opportunity, and just sheer pragmatism that enabled this to progress. But I think one thing I need to kind of state to make, you know, to give the full picture, because we talk about 100,000 refugees, but within the 100,000 refugees, actually, only around 89,000, of the 100,000 refugees, only around 77,000 of those refugees are registered with the Thai government. There was a census which took place in 2019. So it's only the refugees who are registered 2 years before the coup who are eligible. And then within that, of that 77,000 figure, if you remove anyone under 18 and then, you know, over 65, so if you're left with refugees of working age, you're left down, that number is 42,000. So right now there are 42,000 refugees who are eligible to work. So it's, but I mean, that's a significant population. Obviously, we would like to be in a position where every refugee is entitled to work. But I think one of the crucial points around this initial rollout policy is that it's far easier to convert or to kind of transfer refugee status to temporary worker status if people are already within the system. And the process does require, it requires registration, requires, you know, social security, it requires health check. So a lot of the functions of a state require, you know, enrollment into that state's database. Yeah. So I think that's kind of where we are. That's where we are today. I mean, there's a couple, you know, we talked before about, you know, kind of perfect, not being the enemy of the good, or trying to find a perfect solution in an imperfect world. Yeah. And I think there's definitely elements of that, or this challenges that we see ahead. I mean, one of them is around, okay, so what type of work will refugees be able for, and will employers be offering refugees? As I mentioned before, there's, you know, 32,000 jobs that was, you know, publicly offered within the Thai sugarcane industry. That's fantastic. And, you know, many refugees will choose to work in the sugarcane industry. You know, great. That's their decision. Fantastic. But also, I know from speaking to refugees that many of them don't want to work in, say, construction or in agriculture. And actually, they have the skills to do something a little bit different. You know, many refugees speak multiple languages. And as I mentioned before, almost 2,000 refugees are working as, you know, nurses, as teachers, in kind of community, working within the community, providing services. And so you think, well, actually, yeah, if we kind of broaden our horizons from migrant work, from kind of, you know, dirty, dangerous, to something a little bit different, there is a huge potential, not just for refugees, but also for Thailand, for kind of broadening our conception of migrant work, and making sure that also employers, that we can really match the skills that refugees have with the opportunities that the Thai economy and Thai society has, and not kind of confining it to, you know, agricultural construction and kind of physical labor. And of course, those industries are very, very vital. Refugees will do fantastic work in them. But if we're looking for a whole of community solution, that's going to be imperative. And I think the other thing, it's also really important to mention, I haven't mentioned until now, is that within that refugee, within the refugee camps, there are a large number, within the refugee camps, there's a significant percentage, around 10% of refugees, who are vulnerable, who are not physically or mentally able to work. This can be, you know, maybe they've lost a limb in landmines, they have a mental or physical or chronic illness, or they're particularly elderly. And so the issue there is, even though they've been given access to work, they're not able to take up that opportunity. So then it's incumbent on TBC, and we've made this commitment that we, in the context of lack of funding, in a context of reduced humanitarian funding across the board, we have to prioritize the most vulnerable. We have to make sure that refugees who are completely dependent on externally provided food assistance or humanitarian assistance, that we maintain that support. That support is crucial. But then it does mean that the wider refugee population will face a lot of challenges, and we are hoping that if refugees, of course, it's completely up to them. It must be consensual. It must have informed consent. It must be voluntary. But we are really hoping that this opens up the path to self-reliance for refugees outside the camp. But also, we are also doing quite a lot of livelihood opportunities within the camp, a lot of agriculture. And so trying to make complementary pathways for durable solutions for refugees. And I think it is, the last couple of months, I cannot tell you how hectic things have been. If you asked me, 1st of January, what would I think this year would look like? It wouldn't look like this. And that's, you know, from refugee resettlement, funding cuts, right to work. But we are constantly adapting. And I think, again, this kind of coming back to refugee communities, this is where the, you know, camp committees are so essential in speaking to refugees, in helping both once they're in the camp, but also when they've left the camp, kind of making sure they're having their needs met, making sure they're okay. And yeah, this the policy right now is not 100% perfect, but no policy is, right? And certainly not within a couple of months of it first being, you know, first being enabled and then enacted and designed. So we have, you know, we've come within the last couple of months, we've come a long way. We've really come a long way.
And we've got a long way to go. Just mathematically, I want to sort of look at that, because so you said that this policy came into effect on the 26th of August this year.
It was approved. The amendment was approved on the 26th of August, and then the policy came in, was implemented and came into being on the 1st of October.
And so you're saying there are 42,000 refugees in these camps who are of working age and who are registered. And I believe you said,
yes,
who are eligible. And I believe you said earlier that there are currently 2,000 refugees who've already taken up opportunities and are currently engaged in work. So
yes,
rough figure, we're talking about 5% of the eligible population have in the last 3 months, a little bit less than 3 months, have found employment opportunity. So just to get your sort of estimation on that, is that like 5% of the eligible population in 3 months? What do you make of that figure? Is that about what you expect? Is it faster than you expect? Is it a little bit slower than you expect? Are you seeing particular obstacles? What is the projection here?
I mean, by the time this comes out, there'll be far, far more than 2,000. I think there's been a little bit of there's a bit of a lag every day. I mean, every time when I go to a refugee camp, there's been a job fair. There's been refugee. I mean, coming into a camp, you'll see literally in some cases hundreds of refugees waiting to leave. So really, that figure, it's being updated by the day, but you're going to get massive incremental jumps. So I'm sure it's going to be much, much higher by the end of the year. And then again, in January, February, just continuing to rise. I think really we're getting a lot of momentum. And I think, look, on the first of, you know, it came into place on the 1st of October. Well, no one can leave on the 1st of October, right?
Yeah.
You still have to, employees have to register their interest. There's actually, employees have to be aware of this. And not all employees are aware of this. We're still working on that. We're still kind of advocating for, you know, to the kind of Thai private sector, making awareness around this. Then after you've you know, got through social security, you have to do a health check. You have there's a lot of steps. And so I think you know, where we are now, it isn't indicative of where we are going. And I think now that money is starting to flow back into the camps, now that I think also these decisions, I mean, ultimately it's with the refugee themselves who has to make that decision. And I think we see this around the world, be it with migration, particularly migration for work, be this decision to move countries or, you know, move into kind of internal migration. Actually, what's one of often the most kind of important factors is someone you know having made that journey, having made that decision. And I think if you think in the first couple of weeks of October, statistically, if you're a refugee, there's no one you know effectively will have made that decision. And now more and more information is coming. More and more refugees are leaving. We're seeing stuff on social media where I think every week that goes on, refugees have more information at their disposal. More information to hand to make an informed decision about whether they want to go and work. I mean, this isn't to say the, and I think I have to be careful here. What I don't want to do is, you know, portray all work opportunities as, you know, fantastic. We know, I mean, look, there is a litany of abuses and issues within the Thai labor market, particularly, you know, around migrant workers. So we have to kind of keep pressure on, we have to kind of keep accountability and kind of keep a spotlight to ensure that refugees are not abused, that refugees get to fulfill all of their economic, their human rights, their social rights, and they are not kind of, they do not become a vulnerable population. But again, really where we're standing right now, this is, it's not just this is, you know, a good option. this is really, I don't want to say it's the only option, but I mean, we're looking for funding. Funding isn't there. The old model of having 100,000 people reliant on receiving food every single week, so every single month, with $1.3 million of food and cooking fuel assistance. It's hard to see that world coming back where we are now. And so, yeah, this is not a perfect solution. There are bumps in the roads, but I'm confident that working with alongside the Thai private sector, working alongside the Royal Thai government, and most importantly of all, refugee committees themselves, we can find a resolution. We can find a pathway for refugees. And I think one important thing here is when I advocate for pathways outside the refugee camps. I don't mean to say that I don't mean to be disparaging about the refugee camps. I mean, refugee communities have done a remarkable job at creating, against all the odds, creating these safe environments, creating support structures, creating avenues where refugees can live in freedom from fear. However, we can sit here and praise the local refugee governance structure, but also we have to acknowledge that no refugee, no person deserves to be born within the confines of a camp. No person should be living their life behind barbed wire. No matter how great we make that camp, no matter how equitable, no matter how much social cohesion, no matter all the events and humanitarian activities or educational opportunities, they're still living behind a wall. And I think this is one step outside of that. I mentioned before, I don't really want to engage in counterfactuals. I also don't really want to make speculation about the future because, if I made speculation, like I said, if this time last year I was making speculation, I look like an idiot. But I think there is the makings of a future for pathways outside of camp here. And I think that's so important because we are going to need to continue to secure and to continue to gain humanitarian resources that we can use where it's most needed in Myanmar. And that is not in refugee camps. The refugee camps, they are safe from attack from the Myanmar military.
What I wanted to sort of zone in on here is you used this word a couple of times, the word leave. Now, I imagine that these camps are far away from economic opportunities, but it's something that I want to understand what the deal is here because, okay, so the refugees, they have job fairs, employers have gone to the camps or sent someone to the camps to advertise that, hey, we are employing. And then the refugees put their hands up and say, yes, I'm willing to do this job. And then you're saying they're lining up to leave the camps. Does this mean that part of the employment of refugees includes providing them with new housing opportunities? Or is it just part of certain types of labor, like agricultural labor and construction labor, that because you are always going to be working on a build site or on a farm outside of a major settlement, it's just part and parcel of those particular industries to provide you with accommodation for the period of time that you're working there? Or what's the arrangement here is what I'm asking.
I mean, with every employer, the arrangement is going to be slightly different, but I can say in many cases, particularly, let's say around agriculture or within certain factories that have hired refugees, dormitory or kind of accommodation is provided as part of that. Yeah.
Okay. But is that only for that period of time, or is it with the view to never have to go back to the camp?
At this stage, the policy, the only refugees who have employment are able to leave the camp. Therefore, let's say within a family, there is one person who leaves the camp for work. Their family will not be able to leave the camp with them at this time. The family would remain behind in the camp. What we're seeing right now is that an employee will leave a refugee camp to work and then send money back to their family. And within their family, let's say if they have children, the schools are still operational, the schools are still running, you still have access to medical care and support structures. So I think initially in these kind of, and this is really in the first couple of weeks, I'm sure, I'm, you know, we will push for change in the coming months and years ahead. The policy will not remain like this, I'm sure, forever. But we do see that right now the family units or kind of I'm not trying to sound like I'm defending separating of families, but I guess my point is right now the employer, right now the employee will leave the camp for work, send money back, and then the family unit can stay within a support structure. The rest of the household would stay in the camp, where they still have access to education, where they still have access to nutritional support, to medical support, and to, crucially, the kind of the social protection mechanisms and the social and the community support and the community network within within the camp. I imagine in the coming months, we may see a change in that, but that's how things stand as of today.
Okay. I mean, it's very good to understand the ins and the outs of these and the nature of the decision that people have to make when they take employment, and it's that understanding that this is not, at least at this stage, this is not a pathway for you to find permanent housing outside of the camp and to be able to bring your family with you and set up a new life there. So it's important to understand this. And going back a little bit, so you say that obviously a lot of these refugees are going to enter into jobs in sectors like construction, agriculture, which, yeah, perfectly fine, perfectly legitimate. But of course, there are a lot of incredibly educated, talented, skilled people who are looking for employment that is more commensurate to the skills that they have. And if we want to talk about unlocking the economic potential of anyone, especially when we're talking about a very large population base, if we want to unlock their economic potential, we want to maximize their ability to bring to bear all of the skills that they have. But with regards to sectors like construction and agriculture in particular, I just want to clarify what, if anything, the policy says about paying conditions, because I know that these types of sectors and mining as well, these types of sectors are across the world notorious for exploitation, because in a lot of cases you're working very far away from authority figures, you don't have a police station nearby, you're very isolated, and a lot of the labor that takes place in these sectors is often informal labor as well. So I want to just understand what the legislation itself says or what the policy itself says. Are the refugees being given the same legal protections that a Thai citizen engaging in a work contract would receive with regards to compensation or with regards to workers' rights and with regard to safe working conditions and things like this?
So all refugees going through this policy must be paid Thai minimum wage. And that minimum wage adjusts, or that minimum wage fluctuates from province to province. But yes, that's 100% part of the policy. All refugees must be paid minimum wage. As to your follow-up question, I'm not 100% sure if it's... I don't want to state on the record if it's 100% equitable to a Thai citizen. My understanding is it's equitable to other migrant labourers. Effectively, there would be parity or equality between a refugee employee and Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia migrant labor also employed in the same companies. There should be parity, but I can't speak to. I'm not 100% sure what in terms of sick pay, notice period, all that kind of stuff. I can't speak to that.
Yeah, but I think that the important takeaway there is that we are not looking at a situation in which an employer would potentially be saying, well, you know what, I've lost my Cambodian, my Lao migrant worker, but silver lining, I can pick up a refugee worker and I can pay them less and give them worse conditions and harass them, da da da. So at the very least, to these types of sectors, whether it's agriculture or construction, that are very heavily dependent on migrant labor, the transition from migrant labor, if I'm understanding you correctly, to refugee labor does not represent for the employers an opportunity to cut back on wages and safe working conditions and all these other requirements that they would otherwise have.
No, it does not.
Excellent. Excellent. That's good. That's a very good confirmation to have. So I think it's a fascinating topic. It's a very broad topic, and from what we've discussed, it looks like things are turning positive to some extent anyway for the refugee population in Thailand. And this is definitely an excellent recognition by the Thai government of the needs of the refugee community and of the additional strain that community has come under because of a variety of international outcomes and events recently, and a mutually beneficial move to fully capitalize on the skill potential and the human potential that they have living within their borders and have had living within their borders for quite some time. So one would expect that both the refugee population themselves and Thailand more broadly are going to come out of this significantly better off, which is an excellent thing.
So if anyone is interested to hear more up-to-date information about TBC or the refugee camps, please look at TBC's social media or our website, or you can contact us at tbc@theborderconsortium.org for more information.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast. We hope you liked what you heard today. And if so, you might be interested to know that over the years, we've built an extensive archive that now numbers in the hundreds of episodes, all of which are freely available to anyone who wants to listen. Our latest estimate is that it contains well over 360 hours of interesting, thought-provoking, even inspiring content. That's 15 days of continuous listening for those willing to forego sleep and want to go from episode number one until the one you just heard. In other words, there's a lot there. These past interviews, they capture the stories, struggles, and triumphs of Myanmar's people, along with the insights of foreign allies and observers who've played a role in navigating these critical moments. There are also more than a few discussions covering spiritual journeys thrown in as well. Together, our archive forms a rich tapestry of perspectives documenting pivotal points in the country's history and offering a deeper understanding of its complexities. However, producing episodes and maintaining this archive takes a significant investment of time and resources, and we rely on the support of listeners like you to keep it accessible. If you found value in what we offer, whether through today's episode or a deep dive into our past discussions, we invite you to help us sustain this work. Your contribution allows us to maintain and continue expanding this archive, as well as producing new episodes free of charge to all. So consider making a donation at insightmyanmar.org/donation. Yara nangka yau nyana dadu ya dalam diri ganesa di mana wika dah besi yana besi yo. Hoba yara nanda daya nangana yara nanya daya nampoda ba yara nampoda.